Welcome to Radio Maria England for the fourth season of our Science and Faith show. My name is Marta and I'll be your host this evening. I'm head of biology at Nicholas Breakspear Catholic School in Hertfordshire. I co-direct the Faith Journeys in Science project that so far has taken us to parishes across Cambridge, St Albans and London, and now chaplaincies across the UK with Father Robert Verrill. So we co-direct this project together. And this project is happening live thanks to a generous grant from ECLAS, Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science, in partnership with the Templeton Religion Trust. I feel very privileged to introduce Professor Julian Hughes and Dr. Monica Gondratovic. We're also very fortunate to have two students from the chaplaincy, Sam and Thomas. Julian Hughes was an NHS consultant for over 20 years in North Tyneside and Newcastle. He was honorary professor of philosophy of aging at Newcastle University and subsequently professor in old age psychiatry at the University of Bristol. He advised various national and international bodies and was the deputy chair of the Nuffield Council of Bioethics. Monica obtained her medical degree from the University of Cambridge in 2019 before working as an NHS hospital doctor in Exeter and Birmingham. While undergraduates, she was introduced to the emerging, expanding and exciting area of molecular genomics and genetic medicine and was able to contribute to research papers in the field of epigenetics. She would later complete a master's degree in genetics at the University of Exeter and at Cité Université in Paris, France. We also have Sam, who's in his fourth year of the Integrated Masters in Zoology, and Thomas, who's in his third year of the Civil Engineering degree. What is it that you do at the moment? What does your day-to-day entail? Maybe Monica, if you want to tell us what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis.
As you rightly pointed out, I am a trainee histopathologist. That means I am actually a doctor. Lots of my medical colleagues don't believe that histopathologists are doctors, but we are essentially the unseen brains behind the hospital machine. So if anything is ever cut out of somebody, or if a biopsy is taken, if a surgeon cuts a tumour out, that will come to me and my colleagues and we will have a look at it, cut it up and basically decide what's going on. And through that, we can give diagnostic guidance and we can characterise whatever normally a tumour is, but it can be pretty much any pathology. And we also are the people who do autopsies. And through that, I think we get most of our notoriety, but they're normally sort of natural deaths. So forensic pathologists will do the exciting criminal ones, not me.
What about you, Julian? What is it that you do at the moment?
Well, facetiously, I'm tempted to say nothing because strictly speaking, I'm retired. But what I do at the moment mostly is write. And so I write about things that used to be relevant to what I did in practice. So I was an old age psychiatrist, but also had an interest in philosophy and ethics. So I've been writing mostly about philosophical and ethical issues to do with dementia and aging. I think that's what I do now. Just very briefly, for most of my career, I was a consultant in old age psychiatry, which means that we looked after any older people with mental health problems. So often this would be people with dementia, but also people with depression and any other form of mental illness, such as schizophrenia or anxiety or post-traumatic stress disorder and so forth. So that was mostly what I did. I had a particular interest in palliative care for people with dementia, and I used to, towards the end of my career, we had a special team that went into residential care homes simply to look after people in residential care homes. And we also had a specialist unit for people who had severe dementia and also had behavior problems that were regarded as challenging. So those are some of the areas that then I reflect on when I'm writing these days. I am trying to write something that might be more popular, but I haven't really... I keep on saying that this year I'm going to write a novel, but I haven't done that yet. But, maybe next year.
What makes you think that what you're writing about now isn't popular? What do you mean by popular?
Well, every time I write a book, my wife always describes it as a bodice ripper. But I think she's joking. because mostly books about dementia and ethics don't become number one bestsellers.
Sam, what is it that you do?
So I'm currently doing a research project on iridescence as camouflage. So that means my day-to-day at the moment is going out into Lee Woods just across the suspension bridge each day. So I'll be, like on Mondays, I'll be taking out a big bag full of different types of beetle, pinning them out in the woods with mealworms. Then each day for the rest of the week after that, I'll be going back into the woods and having a look to see if the mealworms have been eaten by birds. Oftentimes the entire beetle has disappeared and it's quite a faff trying to look for it. Often it's just completely lost because leaves and stuff. Yeah, so that's my day-to-day. And then I have to look at the leaves who put them on afterwards to sort of get data on how glossy they are, because the camouflage of the beetles will interact a lot with the glossiness of the leaves. So you need to account for that in the data, even if it might not even be relevant at the end of the day. But that's currently what I'm doing most of my day-to-day.
I don't want to say real-life application, because that's real life, but what's the interest? What can you extract from that study that you're doing, and what can you apply that to? What problem are you trying to solve?
The broad stroke is we're trying to figure out if iridescence has any function as camouflage. If it does, then that's great, and it could be useful, say, for army camouflage or something like that, or it could inform fashion and things like that. If it doesn't, then, well, why are these little beetles iridescent? It could be for, thermoregulation, or it could be to do with sexual selection or something like that. But we need to try to rule out, basically, if it's camouflage before we can move on to the next thing.
Cool. Thomas, what do you do?
Yeah, so as mentioned, I'm in my third year studying civil engineering here at the University of Bristol. And part of that involves my research project this year, which is to do with seismic isolation in particularly low-income countries such as Nepal, which is kind of the country we're focusing on. And so we're looking at a way it's kind of quite topical at the moment with the Turkey and Syria earthquake. But yeah, we're looking at a way to get these life-saving kind of structural foundation seismic isolation designs, which can be put into not even tall buildings, but just your regular homes, your regular houses, and can be installed on a wide scale over the whole, country. But to do that, they need to be affordable, they need to be cheap, but they also need to work, and they need to be good at what they're designed to do. And so that's what my research project is on at the moment. But apart from that, it's a lot of design work, it's a lot of maths, as you can imagine from that sort of degree. But no, it's very enjoyable, and it's a good way to spend my time.
So this is obviously science and faith. So you've told us about what is that you do kind of professionally or academically. But could you also tell us a little bit about that more kind of personal aspect of your lives? Because we're at a Catholic chaplaincy at Bristol. So if you just want to tell us, have you always been a Catholic, or did you have a conversion later in life? Have any communities? Dominicans seem to be really popular among scientists, especially who are Catholics. It seems like a lot of conversations, really interesting conversations around science and faith happen with pints in their hands or some sort of alcoholic beverage. So, as any particular religious community or any particular priest had an impact in your Catholic faith, or any teachers like in my case or other people's cases. So if we just want to tell us a little bit about your Catholic backgrounds. Thomas, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in London, actually in an ecumenical community there, which was, just kind of obviously coming into when I kind of not left that, but kind of left that for a time to be here in Bristol. It was kind of obviously very different because it's very much a Catholic community here, and it's kind of a different ecumenical community back at home. But in a way, that kind of just, I see it as it was just always helpful, and it kind of actually strengthened my Catholic faith rather than anything else. I've always seen kind of particularly the topic of science and its relation to faith as something that I've always wanted to explore. I've always been interested in science from a very young age and wanted to kind of develop my understanding of it, the kind of the intricacies of, I don't know, especially in kind of my context of civil engineering and design, looking at the world and all of these intricate things that kind of, you know, and these rules, and it kind of all comes together to make this, you know, this beautiful thing. And I look at that and I want to kind of get to, I want to understand it. I want to kind of grasp it and get my head around it. And it's a really kind of beautiful thing. And I just see that as kind of a very much God-given thing and a God-given desire to kind of look at the world and understand the world and try to understand what's going on. And so to me, it's always been, science has always strengthened my faith in a way. And I look at the world and I look at everything around me and I think, gosh, that's just really showing off God's beauty. And that's just showing off, you know, everything, every little bit is kind of showing off a hidden part and nature of God, but kind of revealing it in nature around us.
Julian, you have to top that now. So have you always been a Catholic?
Yes, I'm a cradle Catholic. Very early on, I was educated by nuns in Philadelphia. My father was studying there for a couple of years. So we lived in America, and then we came back to the UK, and I was educated by De La Salle Christian Brothers in South London. And then, for my sixth form, I went to Worth School, which is a Benedictine abbey in Sussex. And then I went to Oxford to St. Bennet's Hall, which is a Benedictine place, or rather was. It's been closed recently. And but most of my tutoring there was by Father Brian Davies, who's a Dominican, and he's now professor at Fordham in New York. And so he taught me most of my philosophy. So I think that's the kind of formal education. We had a very sort of active parish when I was growing up. We've always remained practicing Catholics. I suppose I would say, it's a bit invidious to name anybody apart from Brian Davies, who remains a good friend. But we also, for a long time when we were up north, we went to a Passionist parish. It's actually a Passionist retreat centre called Minster Acres. And
sorry, what does Passionists?
Passionists is just an order of priests and brothers. And there was a priest there called Father Mark White. He had a very good influence, I think, on our children as they grew up, our three children. He also taught me, I think, he said lots of things that were interesting, but I think one of the things was that religion is very ordinary in a sense. I think when I was working, I often thought that my religion was something a bit odd or extraordinary. But Father Mark was very good at just making one see that actually to be religious is just the ordinary way to be. And that it's actually extraordinary not to be religious. So that was Father Mark. But while I'm being invidious, I would also mention Father Michael Campion, because then we went to a parish in Jesmond in Newcastle, and Father Michael Campion was also extremely good at making us regard Catholicism as the main thing in, I'm sure, if he were to hear this, he would say that's not what I said, but so not maybe not the main thing, but he emphasized the importance of mercy and of God's mercy rather than the more almost traditional Catholic thing of emphasizing how guilty we should all feel because we're all so bad and we're all such sinners. So Father Michael was rather good at talking about mercy. He also famously started all his masses by saying that everyone was welcome in the church, whatever age they were, whatever their sex or gender identity, and whether they were married, single, or divorced, everyone was welcome in his church. And I always thought that was rather inspiring. Is that enough?
That's lovely. Thank you so much. Monica, what about you? Have you always been a Catholic?
I was a cradle Catholic. And I come from a culturally Polish background. I'm third generation. And so growing up, I thought that was very tied in with my faith. My parents probably won't thank me, Mama and Tata, I know you're listening, if I say that I didn't really learn very much about my faith growing up, even though I always knew I was Catholic and I held it as as something to be proud of. So I didn't, for example, know how to pray the rosary growing up. You know, I'd go to church every Sunday, and I always loved getting into arguments with people at school about faith and about God, and the existence of God. And I went to secular schools. For me personally, I think that was a good thing because I'm quite argumentative. And so I think it sort of made me, making me riled up about my faith was encouraging. And I liked to stand out a little bit. Later when I went to Cambridge, that was the time when I would say I had a sort of mini conversion. It was the time when I started to learn really what faith was and what it could mean. I started to learn about Catholic authors, Catholic apologetics. I saw how other young people around me were living their lives. And I, for the first time ever, found a Catholic community. At Fisher House, we have a library, and we would all sit there and study and be very, very stressed out. And, you know, and then every now and then a conversation totally unrelated to work would break out, and it would normally be centered around Catholicism. And it was just so wonderful. And I know that a lot of people find their faith that way through university. My sister, my twin sister, Joanna, she came here to Bristol. And she had exactly the same experience. You're surrounded by other lively, intelligent, enthusiastic Catholics, and everyone brings their own experience to the table. When I was at Cambridge, the chaplain there was Father Mark Langham, who has sadly passed away. And he was just a spectacular man. And he was so welcoming to everyone, no matter what their background. And through him, I saw what I thought was impossible in this country. I saw conversion to the Catholic faith of people who had no links at all to Catholicism whatsoever and were introduced to it the first time at university. And I honestly think that that was most of those were due to him. After leaving university, I kept in contact with all of those people, and I got to know a lot of the people who my sister knew from the Catholic chaplaincy at Bristol. My faith continued to grow in different ways. I became very close friends with the previous chaplain here, who is Father Rupert Marlin. And he, I think potentially through him, I sort of started dabbling in the idea of the Tridentine Mass, the traditional Catholic Mass. And I'd say since then, I've started exploring this more, and I feel as though that enriches my faith. And I will continue trying to explore and expand my knowledge of the faith and my practice of it.
What about you, Sam?
Well, me again. I'm a cradle Catholic. I went to Catholic school. Catholic school, they served me very well in sort of teaching us about some of the saints and that sort of devotional aspect. But it wasn't really until I came to university that I realized the sort of more intellectual foundations of the faith, which I've found really sort of important to me for actually being able to sort of live my own faith rather than just the faith of my parents. And so it was really coming to Bristol, getting in conversation with people like Father Rupert and some of the other older students at the chaplaincy, and realizing that there is a reason to believe what we believe, and that the faith, you know, has such great depth in terms of the intellectual side of it, and there's basically no question of the faith that hasn't already been thought of and answered by someone, usually Aquinas. I just found that really wonderful, and I've really appreciated at the chaplaincy always people like Father Rupert and all of the lots of the other students always being ready to have those sort of more interesting discussions on faith and all that sort of thing, which I've found really valuable for forming my own ideas of what I believe. And if I could bring it slightly onto what I've been studying as well, I've found it quite nice to muse, I suppose, on the fact that with these, say, these pretty little beetles that I've been studying at the moment, science can say what the different types of colours they have, their shape, all that sort of thing, you know, the wavelengths of the light and so on, but it can't answer the question of is it actually beautiful or anything like that. Science isn't the right tool to answer that question. That's really helped me sort of think about the relationship between something like faith or philosophy and science. Science isn't the right tool to answer every question. As a scientist, how that's helped inform my faith as well.
Through your professions and your own lives, how have science and faith interacted, you know, both positively, negatively, or maybe, you know, not at all?
Yeah, that's maybe why I steered clear of the question, because actually, sometimes I think they have nothing to do with each other. I would say that, of course, having an intellectual, lively mind, an inquisitive mind, is something that goes hand in hand, right? You can't really be a scientist without it. And it's very useful to have a lively and questioning mind when approaching your faith. I think as scientists, I would say that we maybe have a bit of a harder time of learning about our faith because it's not something that's immediately obvious in our day to day. So I think actually, as scientists, we have a responsibility to go out and search literature and search philosophy and become uncomfortable in a subject which is not our alma mater. Whereas literary students will probably come across that on a day to day basis. On a more personal level, sometimes practically my faith does make a difference because I am a doctor. And so ethics is very much tied in with that. But that's the profession rather than the scientific subject.
Well, I agree with that. I think one of my favorite quotes is from something to do with the philosopher Wittgenstein, who once, it was said, he thought of taking as a motto for his book, The Philosophical Investigations, a line from King Lear, which is, I'll teach you differences. So I think when we think about these things like science and faith, we have to think about the sort of different ways in which those things are taken. So if we think about faith and how that might interact with science, I wouldn't be capable of talking at any length about faith as a sort of topic. But there's a sense in which faith just informs our lives, especially if, as we've all described, we've always been religious, then it's just part of our lives. So I'll come back to that in a second. Whereas another way to think about faith issues in relation to science is where there are issues which are salient for Catholics. So issues like abortion, euthanasia, and so on. So those issues are sometimes seen as having a very particular sort of Catholic view of those issues, which of course is not just confined to Catholicism. But so then when I then turn to science, the thing to emphasize is that there are different sorts of science. So for instance, I've been involved in clinical drug trials. Now, you could think of a clinical drug trial which would engage with some of those salient issues of our faith. So there could be a drug trial that's to do with a drug maybe that would induce an abortion. So then immediately our faith beliefs start to kind of kick in. But I've never been involved in any sort of drug trial like that. And a drug trial which is just testing out whether this antidepressant is better than that antidepressant, I mean, as long as There will always be, in any research, there will always be ethical issues, but our views about these things will be, in a way, just simply informed by our Catholic faith. So it's not that we're immediately going to turn to a particular page of the Catechism and say, well, this is forbidden or something. It's just that, you know, if you're doing research on people, you should make sure that you've got consent from them. Catholic teaching is going to support that, but that's by no means a kind of Catholic doctrine as such, although of course we would all want to do that, but lots of people who are not Catholics would also want to be interested in getting consent from people. But my interest, I suppose this is my point, my interest in getting consent from people is informed by my Catholic upbringing, but only in the way that my interest in, for instance, telling the truth is also informed by my Catholic upbringing. But of course, I could be somebody who had no faith, and I would still be interested in telling the truth, perhaps. But I'm just speaking personally. So I'm sort of saying that if you're a Catholic and you've been brought up in the ways that we're sort of describing, then all of your thoughts about how we treat people, how we think about them, they're all going to be informed by one's Catholic upbringing. On the other hand, there are a further example of this, for instance, might be a different type of science. So instead of something that's a bit more something that might seem more like a sort of social science. For instance, I've been involved in thinking about issues of truth telling in the case of people with dementia. If somebody with dementia believes, so for instance, an elderly woman with dementia might believe that her husband is still alive and she's in a care home, and every day she wonders why her husband hasn't come to see her. So should the staff tell her a lie and say, oh, he'll be along later on? Or should they tell her the truth and say, oh, sadly, your husband died? So that's a very kind of clear example of where my Catholic upbringing would make me verge on the side of wanting to tell the truth, if at all possible. At some point, the alternative argument is, well, if that's going to really upset her, is it the sensible thing to do? So at some point, I might want to start drawing on not just the virtue of honesty, but also the virtue of practical wisdom. And I might start to think, well, maybe I can do something else other than telling her the terrible truth. Maybe I can find out how she's feeling generally. Maybe I can offer her a cup of tea and we'll maneuver her away from thinking about the fact that her husband hasn't turned up. So just to conclude this, because I should shut up now, I think there are different types of science, and there are also different ways of understanding where our faith gains a sort of purchase on the things that we're discussing in science.
Although, luckily, I would say that the ethical framework as it pertains to medicine, medics in general in this country, is quite Christian. So everything that you've described, maybe I think our colleagues also do sort of try and practice in that sort of way, but maybe for us it's a little bit clearer. And character traits, I think, is actually something quite interesting to mention with regards to other types of science, not just medical, but all types of research. Science is something which requires a person engaging in it, a scientist, to question constantly. And I think in this country, we are few in number, Catholics are few in number, and we often feel as though we're on the fringes of society. We're automatically considered sort of bizarre, weird, unpopular. And because of that, I think it's much easier for us to then potentially bring something up that's unpopular in whatever other field. So I can, you know, go against the status quo a little bit more readily than other people, which is exactly what the best scientists historically have always done.
I'm wondering if at this point either Thomas or Sam have got any questions for Julian and Monica.
No, nowadays we've got lots of study into genetically modified organisms and genetically modified crops. How does the sort of Christian ethics, say, inform that and the study of that compared to, because we're not dealing with people in a, at least in a direct sense. But there's ethics behind, because obviously it can help lots of people, but at the same time, you know, you could say it's a, but simply playing God or something like that, and could have lots of ramifications that we don't imagine.
The question is on genetically modified crops, and is there potentially a problem there in the face of our Christian faith? I would say quite clearly no, but I think that there are other points to raise. I should also probably preface this, in case it wasn't clear, that I do actually have a background in genetic science and research. With regards to genetically modified crops, there's no problem with it, because we have been essentially genetically modifying animals, crops, for millennia, whatever is at our disposal. As humans, we have the capacity to control the world around us, and genetically modifying a crop is not genetically modifying a soul, right? You know, if we think about if we talk about questions with regards to eugenics, then it's a completely different question, but I don't think we should go into that right now. But with regards to crops, definitely not. It is true that we do have a responsibility to the natural world. You know, we are essentially the gatekeepers and the carers and the guardians of the natural world, of animals, of crops, of agriculture. But we can do that in many different ways. And genetic modification of a crop is just an exciting way to do that. Most of the time, crops have been genetically modified in order to create a benefit to those who are in need of that benefit. You know, having crops growing in drought-prone areas, etc., is the normal example that people give. And so, yeah, I see absolutely no problem with it whatsoever.
So my question, particularly for Julian, but also to Monica as well, was kind of in regards to the friction between science and faith, and just how that relates to, number one, kind of your colleagues that you're working with, but then also the patients that you're treating and talking to.
So maybe I should say something first about the friction. I suppose the question is to what extent there is or isn't friction. And there is this worry. So I'm moving away from science as such, from sort of basic sciences, to think a bit about more about kind of clinical practice. So in clinical practice, there has been a sort of tendency not to make one's religion intrude on one's work. But there are arguments about this. So some people feel that actually it's right and proper to be upfront and honest. And if you have religious beliefs, you should feel absolutely free to express those beliefs. Other people feel that you shouldn't be expressing your religious beliefs to patients. As a psychiatrist, I'm a bit inclined to the latter view, because there is a real worry about, the trendy phrase would be about, the power dynamics between a doctor and a patient, and in particular between a psychiatrist and a patient. And you wouldn't want to raise issues around religion with someone in a way that may be harmful to them. So there is that potential for friction. So, for instance, you wouldn't want to make somebody who is depressed feel guilty in some way if you were suggesting that maybe they should pray more or something of that sort. On the other hand, I think in most cases, there just isn't friction because these things don't crop up. Or if the patient's religious beliefs crop up, that doesn't involve you in particularly saying anything about your own religious beliefs, because you don't want to end up in a state where there is friction between you as a clinician and the person you're trying to look after. So these are kind of delicate issues. But I think that mostly in practice, the issue of religion doesn't crop up. And I think that that in itself is something to think about. When I would, certainly we did a little audit of this, and we looked at the questions that we were asking patients about their religious beliefs, and what we discovered was that mostly the questions were simply not asked. There was a tick box on a form that had to be filled in by the nursing staff when the patient was admitted to the ward about religious beliefs, and mostly it was just not even ticked. And we then tried to introduce some questions into the form that would encourage people to at least ask a question, and even that was not very successful. And there might be all sorts of reasons why that occurs. I mean, there are all sorts of other things which routinely people are meant to ask and they don't ask about. An example might be to do with sort of person's sexual history. So there may be times when you really ought to ask somebody about their sexual history and people just don't do it, or somebody's alcohol history. So there are other things which somehow there's a slight reticence to get into. But I think if you do get into those issues, I don't then think it's necessarily the doctor's role to be discussing those issues with a patient, because usually in hospital practice, we have chaplains. So I think we should be very ready to say, well, there is somebody here who would be well placed to discuss these things with you. I just want to say, because we're sort of talking from our personal experience, the only time when my Catholic faith was more of an issue with patients was perhaps when I started off and I was training in general practice. And as part of that, I did some obstetrics and gynecology. And so I'd made it clear that I had a conscientious objection to taking part in anything to do with abortions. But actually, this caused no noticeable conflict with my colleagues. They just simply accepted that. And I said I was happy to provide, as it were, normal medical care to people. So if somebody was in pain or they were distressed in some way, I was happy to help out when I was on the ward, but I wasn't going to take part in the abortion. It caused no problems for me, is all I want to say. My colleagues were very good. However, we do know that there are some places where this is a major issue, and actually it prevents people from getting on in their careers. It can be quite difficult, I think, for a Catholic pursuing a career in gynecology or obstetrics if they're not willing to get into some of these more difficult issues. So that's an example from my own kind of personal practice. Then I'm sorry to go on so long. And then the only other thing I was going to say was, because you also asked about the relations with patients, relations also with our colleagues. In old age psychiatry, we always worked in multidisciplinary teams. I was almost not surprised to discover in my main multidisciplinary team I worked in for years that actually many of the members of the team had been brought up as Catholics. Most of them had lapsed. But in a way, this reflects what Monica was saying, that the background to our culture is Christian anyway, and perhaps many people who've been brought up Catholic, even if they have lapsed, are nevertheless sort of impelled towards caring professions.
In terms of the medical workforce, there's a very small proportion of Catholics, but amongst Catholics, I think there's a stonkingly high proportion of doctors. There was a running joke at the Cambridge Catholic Chaplaincy that it was entirely populated by female Polish medics, basically, and that was about half of the students.
Welcome back to the Q&A session at Bristol Chaplaincy. Father Robert will be reading out your questions and then directing them to our speakers.
Okay, well, there are some excellent questions here. So this first question is actually directed specifically to Julian, but maybe other people might have opinions. The question is, so my experience in clinical and medical research and practice raises constant moral dilemmas, for example, gender identity. If raising my opinion and or objection would cause friction or create a power dynamic, how does one maintain a Catholic identity?
Well, I think that is just a very good question. I think it's enormously difficult. It depends on the circumstances. There are times when perhaps we might feel that we should always raise our Catholic identity. We shouldn't be afraid of showing that we're Catholics and that that's what we should always do. That might not be quite right. There may be times when it's better to use an old expression, to keep your powder dry and to see if you can influence things in some other quiet way. So there may be times when that would be the appropriate thing to do, but there might be other times when you simply have to say what you believe. I think my inclination under those circumstances would not be to reveal that I was Catholic, but simply to think of what are the rational reasons that I object to whatever it is that somebody's talking about, and simply to put those reasons. You might then be accused of being a Catholic, but then you should retaliate and say, well, what on earth has that got to do with it? I've given you some reasons. You have to counter those reasons or accept them.
Yes, I would definitely echo that. I think Professor Julian has put it very well. And the thing to remember, especially with medical research and clinical care, is that your concern should be the well-being and care of your patients. And so we're all seeing this wave that seems to be unstoppable with regards to misappropriation of gender. And that can be damaging to the care that you give your patient. Because if we deny that gender exists, then fall into difficulties when it comes to diagnoses and treatment, because that is influenced by hormonal status, for example. On a ward, it can be very difficult to know where to place a person who identifies as the opposite gender. And that can create problems for the other patients. And so when it comes to a question like that, one has to approach it in not necessarily a Catholic manner, but a very tactful manner, shall we say, where one has to act in the best interests and in a careful manner towards everyone involved, not just, you know, trying to be Catholic or trying to be political or trying to be modern. And that should be the same for you and for your colleagues. So when it matters, say something. Try not to say that you're Catholic, because you will be, and you probably will be accused. But yes, we don't believe these things because we're Catholic. We believe them because they are true.
Why do you think that nowadays science is regarded by so many people as the only way to knowledge despite its limitations?
It's probably because it's fashionable to say so. It's also fashionable to say, in a very sweeping statement, I'm sure you've come across this, you're all at university, science can disprove the existence of God. Well, that's just totally, that's just total nonsense. It's essentially just a sound bite. And believing that science is the only way to truth is also of the same vein. You then basically have to say, well, what is truth? What do you believe is true? Can beauty be explained by science? You can open up the conversation and question what do they mean by truth, and then automatically everyone ties themselves in knots. I'm already tying myself in a knot, and just because the question cannot be answered.
You know, why have we, as a society, in the UK, in the Western world, moved away from religion? Well, it's a highly complex thing. I mean, I don't think I'm equipped really to give a good answer to that, but it is to do with the ways we've been thinking. We as a society have been thinking over several hundred years. So I think just blaming historical forces is the answer. I think there's something else though. I think that we haven't done the best that we can. We all know that religion, and maybe especially the Catholic religion at the minute, has shot itself in the foot with, for instance, all the sexual abuse scandals. I mean, this means that people are free to just take the mickey out of anybody who says they believe in this stuff, because it's just associated with sort of hypocrisy and gobbledygook and so forth. So that's one way in which we've shot ourselves in our feet. But the other thing, so I'm now going to go off on one a little bit. But the other thing is, I think that there's some very basic things, and I think actually I would come back to maybe what Sam and maybe what Thomas were saying earlier, that despite years, decades of good Catholic education, I don't think that what we heard from Sam and Thomas was that their real understanding of the faith didn't come until they were at university, perhaps. I would echo that. I think I might have, I don't know, who knows, I might have lost my faith had I not come across the work of, guess what, the Dominican Herbert McCabe, and in particular one article he wrote about creation, which was about the existence of God, and which then appeared in a book he wrote, which is called God Matters. But I mean, so what he said basically was that the word God is the unknown answer to the ultimate radical question, why something rather than nothing. What I think that points to is the absolute mystery that God is. And he based his thought, of course, on the work of Thomas Aquinas, and who said, of course, that we can know that God exists, but not what God is. Herbert McCabe used to be really quite entertaining about all of this. He used to say things like, for instance, he used to say, you know, when we talk about God, we don't know what we're talking about. Well, if only somebody had said that to all the people I was at school with who have subsequently lapsed, that we don't have any idea what we're talking about when we talk about God. We only know, you know, then it becomes complicated. We know by analogy, we know that God can't be anything like any of the creatures that he created, he or she created, and so forth. If only we'd been taught that at school, we might not have then thought that all of this stuff was such baloney. We might have thought, oh, actually, yes, there is some sort of, you know, the world does raise some sort of mystery. And religion gives us the answer to that.
Well, I would disagree slightly in that we can't know anything about God and that he's a complete mystery. I think we can know God to an extent as far as our reason, which is quite scientific, and also revelation allows us. And they're both two quite intellectual pursuits, which are then accompanied by faith, which can't be explained.
They're both intellectual pursuits, but they're very different in a way. And I think that's particularly why a lot of people are drawn to science, is it's you get this feedback. You can test something, you can do something, and you get this feedback, you see what's happened, what the result is,
and you can get to the bottom of it. You can, you know, if with enough work, you can understand it. Whereas with faith, there's definitely this sense we can get to a point and then we just have to, you know, we have to, at one point, we have to say we have to leave it there. And there's some stuff which we will never know. And in a way that I feel that is, that's, you know, what puts people off, because there's that, yeah, sense of not knowing, which people don't like.
I think it should excite people more than it should put them off. We should probably... These evenings are to talk about science and faith, and actually what we mean by that is natural science and faith. Science in itself, like the word science, means knowledge, and so that can probably extend to, say, philosophy. And through that, we actually... It's a completely different way of approaching knowledge, but a way in which we can almost not put God to the test, but that we can think about him. And unfortunately, there is a misconception amongst Catholics that the two, that faith and reason, are completely separate to one another. And especially maybe amongst those who aren't university educated, they feel potentially... very, very distant from this, from their unfaithful scientific fellow human beings. And I think that's very sad and quite scary. And if we have faith, we should be excited to know more about creation and more about God. I read a book by, can't remember his first name, but it, Bishop Sheed, not Fulton Sheen, but Sheed, who was an Australian, who wrote a book about theology and faith and the art of knowing, and the way in which he describes the pursuit of knowledge and the exploration of creation, it really was a wonderful thing to read. He said, you know, if we are faithful, we should not be content to stay ignorant. We should really search to increase our understanding of God and the world around us.
On a completely different topic, but still vague, maybe might be related to our people with a medical background. So what is the Catholic view on organ donation, for example? If a person meets with an accident and passes away, and he or she had remained indifferent on organ donation, will it be all right for a surgeon to use the organs from a deceased person to that of another person, so they can have a chance of life? And does the church teaching differ from that of the law?
Well, I don't really know enough about it. I mean, I don't think there's any Catholic teaching that says you mustn't give your organs to other people. The issue, I suppose, is whether a surgeon can use somebody else's organs if they haven't given consent. The law on that has changed, hasn't it? There was a pilot study in Wales where instead of having to consent to your organs being opting in, you could... It was the opposite, wasn't it? That it was presumed that everybody had opted in. I have to admit, I'm not quite sure where we stand with the law at the moment in England. I think I would feel a bit unhappy about organs being used without some sort of consent. That might be the consent of the family, who can say that this is a person who would have wanted to do this, so a sort of substituted consent. But it seems a bit much just to go around taking people's organs without any sort of consent.
But I think there's also a problem knowing exactly at what point someone has died. Someone is brain stem dead. Does that mean they're really dead? Because when they've got a, you know, perfectly beating heart, and when you have to kind of anaesthetize someone to harvest their organs, it doesn't sound like they're dead. So it sounds like you're killing them. So there's that problem as well with organ donation. There are certainly ethical issues related to it. So church, as far as I know, doesn't condemn organ donation. Yeah, I think it's sort of, but we need to respect people's wishes, and our body, you know, is something almost sacred. I mean, like when we venerate the relics, you know, we were made in the image of God, and God took on our human flesh in Jesus Christ. So we need to bear that in mind, that we treat our bodies with respect. In the science field that you work in, is there any moment that you thought that the only explanation for an incident or an experience was God's doing?
No.
No.
I mean, it's a difficult one. Nothing like personally, but from just reports that I've read in terms of buildings and, for example, building collapses, and I'm sure structurally, okay, there, that's just how the building collapsed. In some way, I think, you know, if people have survived this and such a horrific calamity, and they were just in the right place at the right time in that building, such that when it collapsed, that bit didn't kind of crush them. You know, you must think that there was some sort of intervention there, at least in my opinion.
The distinction between primary and secondary causality. So in effect, well, everything is God's doing, but God acts through secondary causes, that God gives things the natures by which they have their own power of causality, but ultimately they receive that power from God sustaining everything and being. So everything is ultimately God's cause, but he gives things that the power that they can be real causes in the world. So that, you know, that things act in accord with their nature. But we also believe in miracles, that God can raise things up to act beyond their nature. And anyway, you've got examples of things like using a pen, that a pen by its nature can't write intelligible things on pieces of paper, but by being raised up by instrumental causality, they can, you know, transcend their nature. And in a way, God can do that with natures and raise us up, raise things up to act beyond their nature. So in a way, yeah, I guess we don't often see these things.
I think that question is very, very relative, because when all three of you automatically said no, I was like, well, okay. We've just become so accustomed to, I think, the cellular processes that happen in our cells are quite miraculous. I think the fine tuning of how your cells work, and if you change one letter to a code, it completely can change, you know, whether a person has a disability or doesn't. Just even the foundation that we're working with, it's got to be God's doing. And I think probably most of you feel like that. So in that sense, I don't have to think about the extraordinary, but rather on the ordinary to say that has to be God's doing. So I was focusing on the ordinary when I was thinking about that as well.
Okay, well, this is more sort of a academic integrity. So how do you find, I think maybe for, it's addressed to Monica, basically anyone who's done publishing, I guess, could have an opinion on this. So how do you find the process of publishing in academia and sort of maintaining integrity while being part of an academic system that is not very Catholic?
I would say that I don't think the system that, I wouldn't describe the system as not very Catholic. I would just describe the system as not working. It's easy to keep your integrity, your personal moral integrity in terms of Catholicness, you know, not to involve yourself in research that could compromise your Catholic understanding of the world and your Catholic morals. In current biological scientific research, I can't speak to other scientific research, in order to get publicized or published, I should say, you have to kind of jump through weird hoops and contrive a way into which your paper seems attractive to journals and hopefully high level journals. And there's a lot of crap. And it's just a system that doesn't really work. You know, things are peer reviewed and not peer reviewed very well. And then the more bad research that's published, the more depressed you get, and the more you want to pull out. But it's not Catholic problem, it's just a system problem. And then you think, well, I have to play the game a bit and I have to contrive my words so that they conform to this.
I think the only thing that I would add is that the Nuffield Council on Bioethics did do a study of this sort of thing of some years ago. And the thing that struck me from that was that the tremendous pressure on postgraduates to perform in order to pursue their careers, and that the inclination to falsify results,
or to present them in a positive light, or to omit negative results.
Well, I think that's fine. I think that's great, actually. But actually, what this was talking about was actually falsifying results, because actually there is a lot of research fraud. There's more than we kind of are aware of. But as Monica said, it's because of the pressures of the system, because funding for postgraduates, postdocs, is so poor.
Do you think that there can be maybe too much mercy, and how do you balance mercy with justice? And
I regretted saying what I regretted a little bit, because partly because I thought that Father Michael's point was maybe I didn't convey his point so well, which is that actually he thought that we should just enjoy ourselves more. He has always been someone who is good at encouraging people to enjoy life by pursuing interests in art, music, and so forth. And but to see ourselves as able to flourish rather than to see ourselves as people who are weighed down by our badness. But then I think this question just raises a more profound issue to do with the virtues and to do with virtue ethics, and how you can have virtues which seem to contradict each other. And I don't think I have the answer to that perfectly. So the standard thing is to do with a judge who's required to say, yes, you have to go to prison for the rest of your life, and that doesn't seem terribly compassionate. So that is just tricky. But I mean, I suppose what you have to think about is a sort of a whole system. The system that condemns somebody to life imprisonment should also be a system which in some way supports them once they're in prison. It supports them to make something more of their lives. I mean, they can't make more of their lives in the sense that they're stuck in prison, but they can still reflect and think about what they've done and what they can still do even in prison. So that there's that kind of answer. There's a more complicated, I think, philosophical answer, which I think it's difficult to maybe to be persuasive about. But there was the idea that if you really have the virtues, you should have them all. One of the things I like about virtue ethics is that it encourages the thought that what's important is also what you, not just what you do, but what you become by what you do. So I think the idea of somehow seeking perfection by being able in some way to weigh up and balance all the different virtues so that you will be humble and compassionate and just and so forth I don't think that's a bad model to be thinking of and aiming at. And of course, if we're followers of Christ, then that is a model for us to strive towards. But of course, it's difficult because of the way that we are. I was being a bit hesitant there because I was thinking of one other thing, which is just that the notion of justice should also be thought of in a very kind of broad way, that justice is not, for instance, simply to do with how we allocate resources in a fair way or is not simply to do with punishment. It's also to do with thinking, as it were, rightly, thinking in a just way, weighing things up in an appropriate fashion. And so that gives you some room for thinking that you can be, as it were, merciful even when you're sending the person to prison for life. I wonder if you can still say that if what you're sentencing the person to is death. But I think that's why we should abhor the death penalty.
The last question, I always ask the same question at the event, at each event, and that is, why have you taken time to be... You're all very busy, obviously, so why have you taken the time to be here at the Bristol's chaplaincy today?
Probably many egotistical reasons, but I think it's an excellent thing that you're doing with these programmes, so I feel honoured to be a part of that.
I agree with Monica, but also, I mean, I think the topic is, this is partly what Monica was saying, I think the topic is just a good one. It's worth discussing, and it's very nice. It's been a great pleasure to discuss it in this forum. I just want to quickly add that talking of this forum is that I met my future wife in the Catholic chaplaincy, and I'm very pleased to hear that there are people getting engaged in this chaplaincy. Yes, I hope all goes well.
Primarily, first of all, because Father Thomas asked me to, our lovely chaplain, but mainly it's because, I'm studying science and I'm just very interested in my faith and sort of figuring out more of how these two sort of aspects of my life sort of interlink and interact.
Yeah, and I mean, clearly I'm a student at the university. I'm here at the CAFSOC, and in a sense, there's potentially a lot of other, you know, potential students who have questions about this topic, who are looking about going to university, looking at different CAFSOCs or whatever, and having a voice saying, or a community that, you know, promoting that is actually a really important thing as well.